Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Greetings, I'm Linda Perry, Program Director here at WBAI Radio. Join me and our station manager, Bertol Reimers, for a report to the listener. That's this Wednesday, October 13th, from 3 to 5 p.m. We'll discuss the current state of the station, programming, and other issues of interest to you, our listeners. That's Wednesday, October 13th, from 3 to 5 p.m., right here on WBAI New York.
Over listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio WBAI, coming up next, Living for the City. Living for the City on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Hard Time, Mississippi. Boy, born in Hard Time, Mississippi. Boy, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on in this program, for sure. Special guest this morning will be Bobby Rush. We'll get to that in a bit. But just to orient you all, Living for the City is a program focusing on telling stories, our histories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you have lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the real estate industry and the very powerful lobbyists. We look at housing, land, air, and water use, including sunlight, and we do so truthfully, accurately, and without any conflicts of interest. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the program host and executive producer and the senior producer. I'm very proud to announce once again is Jillian Jonas. Before I go further and introduce my guest, a special guest coming up first, I want to familiarize you to the concept of Sankofa. Sankofa is a word in the Akan, Twi, and Fante languages of Ghana that translates to retrieve, literally go back and get. And just like the Sankofa bird that is looking back over its shoulder to see where it has come from, we look back in history to see where we've come from, to better understand how we exist in this current moment, and help us forge and chart a course for the future. And on this day in peace and social justice history, October 13, 1939, we just have one item for you today, one I have isolated. On October 13, 1934, the American Federation of Labor, AFL, voted to boycott all German-made products as a protest against Nazi antagonism to organized labor within Germany. And that concludes the Sankofa moment, in a manner of speaking. But continuing on, as part of my Sankofa moments in time, if you will, I was invited to the city of Mount Vernon, New York, yesterday, up in Westchester County, for a very special event. It was the 100th year memorial service for the interment of Corporal Morris D. Link, one of the 369th Infantry Harlem Hellfighters. And I have with me on the line for just a few minutes Terrence Horton. Terrence Horton is a developer and former commissioner of public works in Mount Vernon. He was the master of ceremonies. He is a listener of this listener-sponsored radio station, and certainly a supporter of this program. Terrence, good day to you, and welcome to Living for the City.
Good morning, Michael. Good morning to the WBAI listeners all throughout this county and region.
Absolutely. Terrence, yesterday we had the 100th year memorial service for the interment of Corporal Morris D. Link, one of Mount Vernon's own, part of the 369th Infantry Harlem Hellfighters. It was held at St. Paul National Cemetery in Mount Vernon. First of all, Terrence, tell us about briefly, because we don't have a lot of time. I have some other guests that I want to bring on, but it was so important because Sankofa, looking back in history, that's what this was all about. That's what this is all about, telling our story, telling our history. So tell us about the 369th Harlem Hellfighters, the infantry. There's so many stories there. I mean, I met, before I let you speak, sorry, Terrence, but I'm just so excited. I met yesterday, as part of this ceremony, I met a filmmaker, Alan Platt Sands, and he's from the Rainbow Division Productions. He is creating a 10-part series around the 369th and all that incredible history. So tell us about the 369th, Terrence.
Yes, good morning once again. In that vein, I am currently being contacted. I'm getting my phone is ringing off the hook because a documentary is, they're trying to produce a documentary now just on the events of yesterday's event. It was, we celebrated an historic moment in time whereby we had Dr. Kowalski from mm-hmm. 1st Division yep. flew in just for that occasion. That's right. And then flew back out. 369th Harlem Hellfighters, they were their most fiercest fighting group of men for all of World War One. 191 consecutive days in battle, and they never yielded an inch. Mm-hmm. The Germans called them, dubbed them the Harlem Hellfighters, because they gave them hell every minute of the day. They fought night and day in trenches. That's the true trench warfare that took place.
Yeah.
The city of Mount Vernon is proud to have 85 men from Mount Vernon get, gave their lives in the ultimate sacrifice for World War One. And Morris, Corporal Morris D. Link earned the French War Cross. And on August 25th of this year, President Biden, the Biden administration, honored the 369th and Corporal Link with the Congressional Gold Medal. It was a proud day for the state. It was a proud day for America. Our troops across the board all celebrated on today's event and historical memorial.
Well, that is pretty incredible. A lot of people turned out, people from Mount Vernon, community members, family members, the mayor of Patterson, Sean Patterson Howard. It was quite an event, and I was very proud to have been asked to come there by yourself. You are a supporter of the work that I've been trying to do, not just here in Living for the City, but in earlier iterations of my sojourn here at WBAI, particularly in the mornings. The history, and we can't get into all of that here, but you mentioned how the German soldiers dubbed the fighting three
Harlem Hellfighters,
dubbed them that. And one of the things that I was talking to Alan or finding out from Alan about their heroism is in some cases, not all the cases, I'm not going to say I'm speaking of Alan Platt Sands, the filmmaker I spoke to, talked about how you know, after these wars, after these battles started, the Germans would kind of like mic drop their carbines. That's it. I'm out. I'm done. I don't want to fight up. I don't want to go against them. And how the American soldiers would not allow the Harlem Hellfighters, well, they weren't Harlem Hellfighters at that time, but would not allow the black soldiers, this regiment, the 369th, to fight on the side of the U.S. forces. Just talk briefly about that.
Yes, the Harlem Hellfighters, initially, they were used only for menial tasks. They were relegated to some of the most, the lowest forms of service, where they would just bring food or shine shoes, just make small deliveries. At that time, they did not, for whatever reason, the U.S. military did not see them as a viable fighting force. The French, when they got over to France, France says these individuals want to fight. They want to give them opportunity. What made them so unique, they maintained in their U.S. Army-issued uniform, but they were issued also French weapons, French certain gear, helmets, and that's what made them so distinct, because they achieved this recognition far beyond any other fighting force of that day during that time in moments in time, and they achieved such a great accomplishment because the French had seen that these individuals were capable, and they were so happy because, believe it or not, what we see now in history, some of the most important turning points of those skirmishes and those wars and in Sokolt, that the 369th Harlem Hellfighters, they led the battle. And you had that one individual that Congressman Suaze had brought to the attention. He fought 31 German patrols off individually by hand-in-hand combat. That's what gave those individuals such recognition. This was a renowned fighting force, and we're proud of our soldiers. Harlem should be proud, and state should be proud, and that's why we want to give a special recognition to Governor Hochul, because Governor Hochul made it her responsibility to make sure that she provided a letter of recognition while we were having our ceremony. The governor emailed that letter, and it was transmitted to all of us while we were there.
Well, bravo to our governor, Governor Hochul. And thank you to you, Terrence Horton, for inviting me and for being the master of ceremonies for this event. We're talking about the 100th year memorial service for the interment of Corporal Morris D. Link, one of the Harlem Hellfighters, Mount Vernon's own, one of the 369th Infantry Harlem Hellfighters. The regiment, again, the 369th Infantry Harlem Hellfighters. There is so much history there. Go ahead, Terrence.
Mike, just in 2 seconds, please and understand. I predicate many of my information off the Sankofa Bird because I listened to you. I listened to you when you were 7 o'clock, when you were hosting, producing, and doing all of the work. Now, today, also the Sankofa, in Sankofa Moments of Time, Jesse Leroy Brown, on October 13th, 1926, he became the U.S. Navy's first black fighter pilot. Mm. So that's important for today.
Sure.
And also, in 19, we have, it was, oh, yeah. Who is, excuse me, T. Walker name. Angela Davis, captured by FBI agents in New York Hotel today in 1970. So that's what it's Sankofa Moments in Time as
that's
well.
That's right. That's right. Thank you so much, Terrence. Terrence sends me these things, and sometimes I can incorporate them into what I'm doing. Sometimes I don't have enough time, but Terrence is always on it, and I certainly appreciate you acknowledging the role of the Sankofa Moments in Time that I try to bring to
this. It is so important, Michael. We all have a debt of gratitude to you because the Sankofa, always looking back, helps us know if you don't know where you've been, it's impossible to know where you're going.
Absolutely. Terrence Horton, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Terrence Horton. Terrence Horton, developer and former commissioner of public works in Mount Vernon. He was a master of ceremonies yesterday at the 100th year memorial service for Corporal Morris D. Link, Mount Vernon's own, one of Mount Vernon's own, part of the 369th Infantry Harlem Hellfighters. There's a whole lot of interest in the Harlem Hellfighters. There's a massive book about this, a film coming out, so much going on. So do keep it right where it is. You'll find out a lot of information on this radio station, WBAI. It's commercially free and listener sponsored. We have been on the air for 60 years. Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's right. 6 decades plus 61 years. Thanks to listeners just like you. And before we move on and bring on our special guest, our very special guest, I want to ask you to consider becoming a member of the station. Mm-hmm. You can do that by calling our pledge line. It's very simple. Make a contribution, whatever you think you can, whatever is comfortable for you. If you listen to this show regularly for the information that myself and Jillian Jonas brings you, in fact, just let me hit this before I move on. 9 landmark 1840s houses at 44-54 9th Avenue, 351-55 West 14th Street in the Meatpacking District face demolition. Village Preservation has received the incredibly disturbing news that the city has ordered the near-complete demolition of 9 city, state, and federal landmarks on the northeast corner of 14th Street and 9th Avenue in the Gansfort Market Historic District. Now, you know, that's just part of what we do here on Living for the City, land use issues. We're going to be talking about that in coming weeks here over WBAI. So I'm going to ask you to make a contribution, do what you can in support of Living for the City, in support of WBAI. Let's hear from you. Make that call now at 212-209-2950. $25, $50, $100, whatever's comfortable for you. Make that call right now. 212-209-2950. Bobby Rush, upcoming.
And the show had a wonderful time. Been down in Mississippi and the show had a wonderful time. I got high get that shine. You know my friend turned me down on Bill Street. Seen everybody I wanted to meet down in Mississippi. Sure had a wonderful time. I got high down there, high as the Georgia pine. Down in Mississippi, where the green grass grow all the time. I'ma leave home, come back. My so-called friends always talking about Bobby Rush. I saw your woman doing whatever while you were gone. I just said, hold it. If they were really my friend, they wouldn't be talking about what they saw her do. Never tell her don't do old Bobby Rush like that. I heard a lady say the other night, child, my husband didn't give me but $150 this week. Another lady said, huh, that was my husband. They give me about $150, I'd have thrown her back and even got a divorce. But the woman was saying that she don't have no main money or no husband. She just wants you to leave so she can move in and get what you got. Look in your friend's face and tell her what I told my friend. Friend, hear what I said. I said, I ain't stuck yet. Hey, friend, I ain't stuck yet.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have a good time the rest of this morning here on Living for the City. I Ain't Studying Ya. That's Bobby Rush's autobiography, My American Blues Story. I don't want to waste or spend too much time. I'm not going to say waste, but I don't want to spend too much time introducing a man who needs none. But so our listeners know, our next guest is a two-time Grammy-winning legend, Blues Hall of Famer, and 13-time Blues Music Award winner, whose autobiography about his life and nearly 70 years making records was released in June. Welcome, Mr. Bobby Rush. Thank you so much for being on Living for the City.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm enjoying it already and haven't just getting started.
Just getting started. First of all, speaking of less getting started, I don't know, I'm jumping ahead here, but your name, Bobby Rush, it's not like it was, for instance, my name. Actually, I have three. It's Michael G. Haskins. But Bobby Rush, that's all one word. Tell us about that.
My real name is Emmett Ellis, Emmett Ellis Jr. I'm named after my father. Mm. So I was looking for a name when I was a young boy so I wouldn't be able to reflect on my father being a pastor of a church.
Yes.
And a preacher. And the love I have for my father and respect I have for my father and what he did as a spiritual man. And so I believe that's a personal thing. what I believe in spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want, and I knew, well, I didn't know, I just thought maybe when I was growing, when I was a little boy, 8 or 9 years old, I just could see myself being this entertainer of the world, being big superstar, whatever. And I didn't want to say, Emmett Ellis coming to town, it'd be my father who was a pastor of a church.
Right.
So I wanted to change my name, but I went to many names before I got to Bobby Rush. I first named myself Bobby Adenhouse, because I'm president.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to name myself Roosevelt Bobby Rush. But there were too many names and too many syllables.
Mm-hmm.
So I come outside, I got it, man. I said, Bobby Rush. Nobody called me Bobby. Nobody called me Rush. Everybody called me Bobby Rush.
Bobby,
you know,
Rush.
It's many Bobby's and many Rush, but ain't but one Bobby Rush.
That's for sure. Bobby Rush. Well,
he
is my guest here on Living for the City here on WBAI. I'm just delighted to have you with us. There's so much to cover. Of course, we can't cover it all. I want you to give us little snapshots of your life, your musical life. But we have to first start with your family life, your young life, your roots, if you will.
Let me kind of set this frame. Maybe this will help for people to get in line and who I am and what I am and why.
Perfect.
I do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And how long I've been doing what I'm doing.
Okay.
I was born in a little place called Homa, Hainesville, Louisiana. I left my little hometown in 1947. With my father and mother, went to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, in a church he was preaching at, and we moved there for a better living, a better cotton, better growing cotton, because my daddy was a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
He went there so he could grow more cotton and grow more corn and beans and whatever about farming, that he was a bigger farmer, and it worked for him. At the meantime, that's why I formed my first band in 1949, in Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
Wow.
Just a little old two-piece band, a three-piece most of the time. And then in 1951, I met B.B. King, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Lightnin' Hawkins, Lightnin' Slim, Willie Dixon, Lil Walter, and T-Bone Walker, Big Joe Turner, Bo Diddley, Jimmy Reed, John Lee Hooker, and all these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they was living in different places, but Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters was in Mississippi. Howlin' Wolf was in Clarksdale, Mississippi, and he kind of convinced me to go to Chicago. And what I had planned to do was move to Illinois where I could be free as a black man, as a blues singer, I thought. When I said be free, because we couldn't eat in the same place that white people eat. We couldn't go to the same place to go. We certainly couldn't go to no hotels. There's a lot of things we couldn't do as musicians, and especially as black musicians.
Right.
So I thought maybe if I went to Chicago, I had met a few guys who had been to Chicago, like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, were telling me how much freedom they had as black men and black people. And I wanted to get that because I wanted to get out of the southern state. But when I got to Chicago in 1951, J.B. Lenore and Muddy Waters taking me to a suburb of Chicago, which was Blue Island. And I worked for a man for $7 a night. I mean, $7 a night, me and the band.
At the club.
$7.
Mm-hmm.
At the club.
Mm-hmm.
And we played behind a curtain. It's in this book that I read.
Right,
played behind
that's
a curtain every night. What he wanted to hear our music, but not see our face.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just up against a brick wall. I didn't know where to go because I thought when I got to Chicago, I was going to be a free man as a black man.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't so.
It wasn't so.
And I'm going to tell you, since we're talking about this, what my life, since that time, I recorded 397 records. And since that time, I grew older, and I'm blessed to be old. And I got a birthday coming up this in a couple of months. And I'm not 90, but I'm still over 85.
Well, you know,
Bobby
Rush, that's one of the things that I found so intriguing about your book, your autobiography, I Ain't Studying You, My American Blues Story by Bobby Rush, my guest, and with Herb Powell, was how you are are able to weave in to all of these stories, talking about your life, your young life, growing up with your parents down in Louisiana and moving, as you said, around in Arkansas and the beginnings of your career and how that started. But you weave in this history, the cultural mores of the day and the things that you and the other artists had to, other people had to, the challenges that you had in just trying to survive and live. That's what I found so intriguing, and it made me want to read more and more and more of this very readable, very accessible book.
Well, first of all, I think what I've done, the way I came on, where I came up, the way I came up, what I went through, I know a lot of people have did the same thing, and even worse than I had. But what I want people to get from this book when they read it, don't feel sorry for me. Just look at what I went through, and I came out of it and made some progress for myself. Mm. If I can do it as a little country boy, you can too. That's what I want you to come away with this book.
Look at here.
But then I've been so blessed to been able to be a blues man and a black man who crossed over to a white audience, but yet I'm considered as the king of the chitlin' circuit. Mm. In other words, I crossed over, but I never crossed out. Mm-hmm. There's so many guys in my position and in my age and time, if they cross over to the white audience, they really cross out the black audience. Sometimes not intentionally, it's just because the record company, the management, and the people who are around them put them in a situation and take it. Otherwise, they sell out. They have no control of what they do and what they record, where they go and what they say. But I always kept a control of myself. And I always talk about this because I happen to know B.B. King was my best friend. Mm. But that was something he could not do as a man because he didn't have no control over himself, of his own face, of his likeness. Mm. And I always tried to maintain the control of myself and where I go and who see me and who don't. So I'm considered the king of the chitlin circuit. That because I never crossed out my people. I don't want to burn the bridge down that brought me across. I'm an entertainer, but I'm a black man, and I know that first.
Boy, I'm
so,
telling you.
That's been a hard task, but I want people to know as they read this book, go out and get this book.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I want you to look at me and look at the image and the path that I've taken. I know that if I make it out of this, you can too. You know, I want to touch base on something. Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to let you say something. If I had waited another 6 months, or maybe another year, I probably wrote something a little different.
Mm.
Because as I look at how things have changed, but then when I look at it the second time, a little deeper, most of things have changed, remained the same. Mm-hmm. So I wrote something a little bit different if I saw what they did on the White House just a few months as I put this book out. Mm-hmm. I probably would have wrote something about that White House situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I look at how the Floyd had to put on Floyd neck, but I don't want to keep bringing the black and white issue into this, but I want the world to know I've been had a foot on my neck all of my life. And not only me, that most people like myself. And we all, as people, had a foot on our neck, a lack of opportunities, you know, one way or the other, you know? And now we're in another situation with the virus, with this virus going around,
COVID-19,
and you got people still talking about they're not going to take the shots because they're afraid of it. They have their reason, I suppose, for whatever it is, but I tell everybody, taking a shot is just like you sit down to eat your dinner. If you have faith in whatever you believe in, who you believe in, you ask God to bless the food that you're about to receive. And not knowing who fixed it or where it come from, what field it grew out of it, or where nothing. So you do the same thing. Just like when guys smoke a cigarette, you don't ask who picked it or where it come from, who raised it, what's in it. And you just take it. When you have your headache hurt, you don't ask nobody what's in this aspirin. You just take something to hurt, stop your head from hurting.
Mm.
And there's so many things that we are not aware of, but yet we be so aware of the virus and the shot that we don't want to take it, that's because we get the wrong information. You know, we got the wrong information, and most of the time, you know. I don't want to jump from that to this, but I just want to put that out there
listen,
to let people know that.
Listen, you can jump all around all you want. I'm talking with Bobby Rush from his brand new autobiography. I Ain't Studying You. We started out a little bit with some of that music. My American Blues Story, Bobby Rush with Herb Powell. I want to play a little piece of music for the listening audience just to give them a little more flavor. I'm sure many in the audience know who Bobby Rush is. If you don't, listen to this. It's coming up. And then I want to talk to him about, you have a chapter in this book called Play It Again, Daddy. That was so touching and so beautiful. I want to ask you about this. This is one fantastic book. You have to get it. And talking about rethinking things, had I rethought this again, had I finished the book, I would have certainly asked the producers. By the way, this is Hatchet Books.
Yes.
Hatchet Books. I want to definitely mention that it's published by Hatchet, H-A-C-H-E-T-T-E. I'd have thought to ask them to make this as a premium. Maybe I can do that again, but don't start me lying here. But I want to hear some Bobby Rush. Hold on.
Well, first of all, let's make sure that
going down the road, stop at Fannie Mae. Tell her what I heard her boyfriend say. Start me to talk and I'll tell everything I know. So I'm gotta gonna break up this signifying. Somebody got to go. She borrows some money to go to the beauty shop. Gets out on the street. Old George stopped. He knocked her down and blackened her eye. She get back home, you know. She told her husband a lie. Don't you start me talking. I'll tell everything I know.
That's Don't Start Me to Talk, and I misnamed it. I said, Don't Start Me to Lie. That just shows you how cultures, you know, I'm from Norfolk, Virginia. That's where my family is from. And so I just conflated one on top of the other. But it's Don't Start Me to Talking.
Don't Stop Me to Talking. One of the songs that Buddy Williams, better known song. But it's Don't Stop Me to Talking, because if you talk too much, most of the time, you're going to tell a lie anyway, so you went wrong.
see, that's the truth. Now, Bobby Rush, in the beginning of the book, the part one of the book, and then I want to get over to Chitlins. Part one, you talked about Sing It Again, Daddy. Tell us about that. What is
well,
that about?
What happened with that? I had a first cousin, my daddy's brother, child, had a guitar. I was about 8 years old, and he was about 15, and he didn't want nobody playing the guitar unless he was around the little girls. He began to like the little girl and everything. I was a little kid, but I found out what he liked, so I was smart enough to go out to the neighborhood and get all the little girls that I thought he wanted to talk to, and I would bring them around and say, listen, come on, go to my house with me. Son, I call him son. His name is John Scott. We call him son. Son is at my house. Well, they would come around, and he would start to talk to the little girl, and I would say, son, can I play your guitar? He said, okay, well, go ahead, play it. He would let me play it because the girls got him company, got him tied up now, you know? So I would make sure that the girls got him tied up. So after about a year or so, he really got into the girl thing. He wasn't a guitar player anyway, but he had money to buy him one or whatever. I don't know where he got it from, but he gave it to me. And I hid it in the loft. In a bun, because I didn't want my daddy to know I had the guitar, because my dad's a preacher, because I thought my daddy wanted me to sing gospel, and I didn't want to sing gospel, man. I wanted to sing the blues, man, you know? So I hid it, and one day my daddy said, Junior, bring that guitar here, boy. I didn't really know I had a guitar, because, you know, your dad, mom, know everything.
Yep.
I brought the guitar to him, he set me down and said, boy, let me play a little something I used to play to a little girl when I was a little older than you. Well, I thought he was going to sing, glory, glory, hallelujah, when I laid my burden down. He was singing about my mama.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't sing about my mama, didn't sing a gospel song. He said, me and my gal went to Chanky Pen hunting. She fell down, and I saw something. I said, Daddy, a preacher and my daddy? But I wanted to get me a piece of paper because I couldn't ask him what he saw. I figured I would give him a piece of paper. He could draw it.
Oh, man.
I wanted to draw on the paper what he saw. Now, in my little mind, I know what he's talking about.
Right.
I saw something, you know, but I couldn't ask my daddy what it was and what it looked like. I wanted to draw it. So I said, Daddy, sing it again.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, my mom was in the kitchen cooking. She said, don't sing that song, Daddy boy. He went to sing it again. My mom was walking up, and I said, Daddy, how big was she? You told 350-pound boy, maybe a little bit more. Now I know she, I said, what's she had on? He said, nothing but a dress. Now, in my little mind, a fat lady falling down with nothing on but a dress. When her dress went up, man, I could just imagine what he saw. I said, sing it again, Daddy. By that time, my mother walking up behind him. He said, me and my girl, when you take it, hon? He looked around. He couldn't see anything. She fell down, and I kept running.
Oh, that's
all I ever knew.
Right.
But I knew right then I was going to be the songwriter, and I'm going to write some things like what my daddy meant to say, or he was going to say, I wanted to say. And so that's what I ain't studying, you know.
Sing it.
Sing
it again, Daddy. That's from part one of this fabulous book, I Ain't Studying You, My American Blues Story. I hope you all are enjoying this conversation as much as I am. As I said, we can't cover everything, but Bobby Rush did a very good job of taking us from his young days right in through much of his career. So tell us about your relationship a little bit with Muddy Waters. Little Walter, which I found fascinating, who he was and what he brought to the blues. I mean, the way you describe it in there, I could almost hear that harp, that harp playing.
You know.
Tell us about that.
Little Walter was, oh, man. There's so many guys that brought me to who I am. I liked Little Walter because he was so swift with his harmonica playing. I liked the Sonny Boy Williams as a harp player, but I liked him more so as a dialoguist in his lyric and story. Junior Parker, I love the way Junior Parker plays his harp. And so many guys I like. I liked the Harlem Wolf because he was so different in his vocal. I liked Muddy Waters because he was so adept with how he dressed and carried himself. I like Louis Jordan because of what he wrote about things I can relate to, like cows, chicken, and horses, and buzzards, and monkeys, and things I relate to as a country boy. And so when you hear my records, you hear all the elements in my records, and you can hear bitter pieces of 10, 15 guys, ladies, or what have you, and you put them in a bowl, stir them up, and then you got a Bobby Ray soup, you know? And so many. I like Louis Jordan because Louis Jordan wrote about the kind of things I relate to. One particular thing he wrote about, he talked about a buzzard and a monkey was good friends. Apparently, the buzzard wasn't as good a friend to the monkey that the monkey was to the buzzard. So the buzzard convinced the monkey to take a ride with him in the air. Not having wings, the buzzard tricked him in the air, and he got him up real high in the air, and he tried to throw him off the humming for whatever reason. And the monkey put his tail around the buzzard's neck to hold on. But the buzzard perceived that he was trying to choke him. He said, oh, buzzard. He said, you got the buzzard around the neck. You choking me. The monkey said, well, straight up and fly right and stop all this ziggity-zag. Hmm. So that was the name of Louis Jordan record. So my first gold record, I cut it in 1968. Number and by 7-8 was number one across the country. It called Chicken Heads. Mm. Jane Brown had the number two record. I had the number one. Bill Withers had the number three record. To beat them guys out at that day and time was hard to do, and I was proud of myself for beating them out on the chart. That is,
right, right.
So those, so many things.
Yes.
So many things.
Yes.
Little Walter was a guy. I lived in Chicago for 40 some odd years. Little Walter used to live at 12 25 Albany, and I live 1220 Troy.
Right behind him, right?
Little street, mm-hmm. Right behind. I could walk out of my back door and call him, and he'd come to his back door and over his porch, and we would talk there for till we get to, till he wanted another drink, you know.
Well, we're listening, Bobby Rush. We are. We're listening to a little bit of Little Walter right now, and I would be remiss in the moments we have. I don't want to impinge upon your time, but I'm certainly enjoying talking to you. The Chitlin' Circuit. I recorded something reading part of the Chitlin' Circuit, but I won't have time to play that now. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the Chitlin' Circuit and what it was. You said something that's very moving to me, that the place, those places that you all played in throughout your lives in the 50s and 60s were places of respite and comfort. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, first of all, the Chitlin' Circuit is not just juke joints.
Mm-hmm.
What the Chitlin' Circuit, because most of the time the people wrote about Chitlin' Circuit, it wasn't black people wrote about Chitlin' Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the mix of the Chitlin' Circuit, but white people writing about the Chitlin' Circuit, and they wrote about it because they thought it was juke joint. It wasn't a juke joint that made it the Chitlin' Circuit. If they were at that time, and farther back than I can remember, they were feeding. That's what you pay for food, man. And they would feed you chitlins and hamburgers and chitli. You know, and I was so good playing Aubrey, Illinois in 1951, 52, 53, that I was so good the man would fix me four bowls of chitlins and four bowls of chili and give me four hamburgers. And I would sell them all, sell everything but one of them, and sell them all for 20 cents a piece, man. And I wasn't making but $3.50 a night, and I was paying Muddy Waters $5.50 on a Wednesday night to come out and be my guest.
Mm.
I paid Muddy Waters $5.50. I remember I put a band together in the early 50s called Bobby Rush and the Four Jivers. M.O. James,
mm-hmm.
One of the guitar players. And I, because he was making a whole lot of money because I paid him $15 a week.
Wow.
$15, man.
$15, yeah. In them days, as Richard Pryor used to say, that's money in them days.
Yeah, you wait three days, you're making $5 a night, man.
Right. That's right, man. That's for sure. And not only that, but you had all of this while you're pursuing your musical career, you had a hot dog truck and a barbecue joint, too? How are you doing all of this and having them fine clothes and traveling? How are you doing all this, Bobby Rush?
That's the way I didn't have. When making that money on the gig, I had to make money. Man, let me tell you, I had this hot dog stand, and now sometimes I make $12-$15 a day. And $12-$15 a day back in 1950 was a lot of money.
A lot of money.
But I had to buy my own hot dog. And I would be eating hot dogs, man. I would go out, hot dog wasn't for 25 cents. And I would sometimes eat two or three hot dogs, eat my profit up, trying to put advertising for the guy. Hey, man, listen, everybody, man, these are the best hot dogs. Y'all take, you taste some hot dog across the street, go to get you one of them hot dogs. Obviously, eating a hot dog. It's okay, I try one. And I would sell them by they watching me eat the hot dog. They were my hot dog, but nobody knew they was my hot dog, you know?
Mm.
And that's where I sold them hot dogs, man. Parked across there, and I had a little girl working in the hot dog stand. But I was paying her $3 a day. And, man, she was selling sometimes 20, 30 hot dogs a day. Well, 20, 30 hot dogs at 25 cents a piece. Come on, back in 1951, that was a lot of money, you know?
Yes, sure it was. Sure
and
was.
That's what I did. And not only that hustle, but then Al Capone's brother, which is Cesar Capone, I suppose that's what you said. And it gave me a big shot because I didn't record till later because I was working on Rush Street downtown and I thought I had it made because I was working in a place, Bourbon Street, you said no color allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only black man in the place,
mm-hmm.
you know, at that time. And I went to Chess, and I told it in this book. I went to Leonard and Chess with the Chess Brothers to get a job. Bo Diddley was there. Harlan Wolf was there. Jimmy Reed was there. Smoker Hall, Lyndon Hopton, and Willie Dixon. Maybe a few others I can't remember was there with us also, trying to get a job. And I made a mistake of showing the man I could read, didn't know what I was doing. I said, as was that literature on the table, I said, ooh, this is good. The union is merging, man. It's going to be good for us colored musicians to get a better job and better represent us better because we're joining now with the white guys. And Bo Diddley laughed at me. I thought he was laughing because the way I spoke coming from the South.
Mm.
But I think now when I look back, he was laughing because I shouldn't have read to the white people. But when Leonard came out the room, he said, told his brother Bill, said, this boy in here reading something off your desk. He said, where you get it from? He said, off your desk. He said, what did he say? He said, the union's emerging. He threw it back to me. He said, what did he say, boy? He said it to me like that. I said, the union's emerging. He turned around and told his brother Phil, so we can't use that nigga because he can read.
Mm.
So I didn't get the job. Muddy Waters and all them guys, they got the job. They were working at Chess. But I never got a chance to record for Chess. I got a chance to record at Chess because I got to working for the Capone, and they thought I was in cahoot with Al Capone. I never met him, never knew him, nothing. But I used that because I used to go down to record, and he would ask me, say, hey, Bobby, you going to have some money for us today? I said, no, let me talk to my boss. They would let me walk out with the master because they thought I knew Capone, and I did not know him at all.
Mm.
Honestly, I didn't know him.
Well,
but
Bobby,
I used that to my advantage because they thought I was Capone.
Of course. And that held a whole lot of weight still at that time. But, well, listen, Bobby Rush, we are flat out of time. I have to go to another segment right now. I'm talking with the famed Bobby Rush from his book, talking about his new autobiography, Ein Studnje, My American Blues Story. Bobby Rush with Herb Powell. Bobby, I didn't get to your work with Gamble and Huff. You've taken up the harmonica after putting it down for so long a time. We have like 2 minutes if you could cover picking up the harmonica again and how significant that was for you.
Well, they told me the harmonica was my thing that I was ashamed of as a black man.
Mm.
And then because it seemed something real black to me. And at that moment, black people just went into something seemed so black because I was too black for myself and other people around me.
Mm.
When I said too black, I'm talking about it was too country for them.
Country, yeah.
They thought maybe.
Yeah.
And I stopped playing the harmonica. But I didn't know I was giving up something that was traditional. You know, you follow me?
Yes, I do.
But now I know, and people like you and people like in the field of the music and people who love the music now embrace what I do. Let me say to you before I leave, thank you for what you have done. Thank you for what you're doing, what you plan to do. But people like you, whatever you say about me, what people perceive me to be. So thank you for keeping the blues alive and the people that do it, because the blues is the root of all music. It's the mother of all music. If you don't like the blues, you probably don't like your mama.
Oh, man, look at that. Listen, I'm going to call you back in 10 minutes, and we're going to do a little something that we talked about as we started, but you just hold on. We're going to leave with, what are we leaving with here? Dust My Broom, Bobby Rush.
Thank you
so much for being here, and I'll talk to you in a minute.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. Thank you for having me.
I got me another woman. Now my friend can have my room. I'm going to write a letter. Telegram every town I know. I'ma write a letter. Telegram every town I know. If I don't find it in Mississippi, I find it in East Monroe. I don't want no woman running downtown Main Street.
I ain't studying you. Well, I certainly didn't get a chance to cover everything I wanted to with Bobby Rush, but we did cover quite a bit. Dust My Broom. And this is from, not from his album, but I've been talking to Bobby Rush this morning about his new autobiography, his autobiography, I should say, I Ain't Studying You, My American Blues Story, Bobby Rush with Herb Powell. This is Living for the City over WBAI. Thanks to Jillian Jonas. And thanks to all of you who make this possible. Right now, it's time for our candidate statements from the local station board. Please do stay tuned. The Gary Null Show will follow at noon.
This is WBAI New York. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 27 listener candidates.
Hello, fellow listeners. My name is Errol Maitland. Some of you may associate me with programs named Emanation, Wake Up Call, and Democracy Now! I plead guilty. WBAI and the entire Pacifica network must be preserved and strengthened because it cannot be duplicated or replaced. We must invest in growth through partnership in order to press our message of peace and justice. I am committed to ensuring that WBAI respects its listeners and that we become intergenerational again.
I want WBAI to do more and be more, and I'm willing to work for it. I'm Bunupti Kamanthu, known to many as Jeff Monroe. I'm passionate about WBAI and appreciative of the education that I have had here. I would like regular coverage of the full listening area, which goes beyond the five boroughs. There are issues and concerns in northern New Jersey, on Long Island, and definitely in Westchester and Rockland counties that warrant the WBAI treatment. We too support the station and its mission. I have experience in community access TV and would like to help create systems of meaningful outreach.
My name is Nick Nicolutis. I'm an adjunct professor at CUNY. I believe in the power of community radio to inform and reflect the community's values and politics. And I'm running for the local station board to support the mission of WBAI to give a voice to the community who supports it and to build a powerful network of listeners, supporters, and allies to keep WBAI publicly owned.
I am Catherine O'Sullivan, and I'm a performing artist. I get involved. I believe in preserving our independent, diverse, uncensored voices on WBAI and the wider Pacifica network. I'm opposed to giving up any of our independence. We must keep working on our financial stability, completing audits in a timely fashion, getting grants and fundraising. I'm Catherine O'Sullivan. Vote for me and my colleagues running on the Indie Slate.
This is Hazel Pinder, and I am a local station board member. I'm running again because I believe that a strong BAI is essential and has played a significant role in building diverse radical movements. WBAI has contributed to my own education on social justice issues. I'm a retired school teacher who often incorporated some of the programming into my lessons. I want to help build a brighter future for WBAI, and with your vote, I will be an advocate for growth and change.
Matthew Reiss here, R-E-I-S-S. I cover the rackets, sham elections, aborted democracies, news, sports, and weather. I was a preschool student in AOC's district when less than 1% of America protested and ended the Vietnam War thanks to TV coverage. Today, however, the media does not question authority. The task falls exclusively to BAI. Fortunately, the BAI electorate may be the most capable political cadre this side of the border.
To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org. All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
Greetings, I'm Linda Perry, program director here at WBAI Radio. Join me and our station manager, Bertol Reimers, for a report to the listener. That's this Wednesday, October 13th from 3 to 5 p.m. We'll discuss the current state of the station, programming, and other issues of interest to you, our listeners. That's Wednesday, October 13th from 3 to 5 p.m. right here on WBAI New York.